for his stolen and empty childhood, and decided to do the general public a favour in order to make up for his conscious fraudulence. He invited a film crew to follow him as he ostensibly returned to preach the gospel, and took the trouble to explain how all the tricks are pulled. This is how you induce motherly women, he was a handsome lad, to part with their savings. This is how you time the music to create an ecstatic effect. This is when you speak of how Jesus visited you personally. Here is how you put invisible ink on your forehead in the shape of a cross, so that it will suddenly show up when you start perspiring. This is when you really move in for the kill. He keeps all his promises, telling the film's directors in advance what he can and will do, and then going out into the auditorium to enact it with absolute conviction. People weep and yell and collapse in spasms and fits, shrieking their saviour's name. Cynical, coarse, brutish old men and women wait for the psychological moment to demand money and start counting it gleefully before the charade of the service is even over. Occasionally one sees the face of a small child, dragged to the tent and looking wretched and uncomfortable as its parents writhe and moan and give away their hard-won pay. One knew, of course, that the whole racket of American evangelism was just that, a heartless con run by the second-string characters from Chaucer's Pardoner's Tale. You saps keep the faith, we'll just keep the money. And this is what it must have been like when indulgences were openly sold in Rome, and when a nail or a splinter from the crucifixion could fetch a nice price in any flea market in Christendom. But to see the crime exposed by someone who is both a victim and a profiteer is nonetheless quite shocking even to a hardened unbeliever. After such knowledge, what forgiveness? The film Marjo won an Academy Award in 1972 and has made absolutely no difference at all. The mills of the TV preachers continue to grind, and the poor continue to finance the rich, just as if the glittering temples and palaces of Las Vegas had been built by the money of those who won rather than those who lost. In his bewitching novel, The Child in Time, Ian McEwan gives us a desolate character and narrator who is reduced by tragedy to a near-inert state, in which he vacantly watches a great deal of daytime TV. Observing the way in which his fellow creatures allow themselves, volunteer themselves, to be manipulated and humiliated, he coins the phrase for those who indulge themselves in witnessing the spectacle. It is, he decides, the Democrats' pornography. It is not snobbish to notice the way in which people show their gullibility and their herd instinct and their wish, or perhaps their need, to be credulous and to be fooled. This is an ancient problem. Credulity may be a form of innocence and even innocuous in itself, but it provides a standing invitation for the wicked and the clever to exploit their brothers and sisters, and is thus one of humanity's great vulnerabilities. No honest account of the growth and persistence of religion, or the reception of miracles and revelations, is possible without reference to this stubborn fact. If the followers of the Prophet Muhammad hoped to put an end to any future revelations after the immaculate conception of the Quran, they reckoned without the founder of what is now one of the world's fastest-growing faiths, and they did not foresee, how could they, mammals as they were, that the prophet of this ridiculous cult would model himself on theirs. The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, hereafter known as the Mormons, was founded by a gifted opportunist who, despite couching his text in openly plagiarized Christian terms, announced that, "I shall be to this generation a new Muhammad," and adopted as his fighting slogan the words which he thought he'd learned from Islam, "Either the Al-Quran or the sword." He was too ignorant to know that if you use the word Al, you do not need another definite article, but then he did resemble Muhammad in being able only to make a borrowing out of other people's Bibles. In March 1826, a court in Bainbridge, New York, convicted a 21-year-old man of being a disorderly person and an imposter. That ought to have been all we ever heard of Joseph Smith, who at trial admitted to defrauding citizens by organizing mad gold-digging expeditions and also to claiming to possess dark or necromantic powers. However, within 4 years, he was back in the local newspapers, all of which one may still read, as the discoverer of the Book of Mormon. He had two huge local advantages which most mountebanks and charlatans do not possess. First, he was operating in the same hectically pious district that gave us the Shakers, the previously mentioned George Miller, who repeatedly predicted the end of the world, and several other self-proclaimed American prophets. So notorious did this local tendency become that the region became known as the Burned-Over District in honor of the way in which it had surrendered to one religious craze after another. Second, he was operating in an area which, unlike large tracts of the newly opening North America, did possess the signs of an ancient history. A vanished and vanquished Indian civilization had bequeathed a considerable number of burial mounds, which, when randomly and amateurishly desecrated, were found to contain not merely bones, but also quite advanced artifacts of stone, copper, and beaten silver. There were 8 of these sites, within 12 miles of the underperforming farm, which the Smith family called home. There were 2 equally stupid schools or factions who took a fascinated interest in such matters. The first were the gold diggers and treasure diviners, who brought their magic sticks and crystals and stuffed toads to bear in the search for lucre, and the second, those who hoped to find the resting place of a lost tribe of Israel. Smith's cleverness was to be a member of both groups and to unite cupidity with half-baked anthropology. The actual story of the imposture is almost embarrassing to read and almost embarrassingly easy to uncover. It has been best told by Dr. Fawn Brodie, whose 1945 book No Man Knows My History was a good-faith attempt by a professional historian to put the kindest possible interpretation on the relevant events. In brief, Joseph Smith announced that he had been visited 3 times, as is customary, by an angel named Moroni. The said angel informed him of a book written upon gold plates, which explained the origins of those living on the North American continent, as well as the truths of the gospel. There were, further, 2 magic stones set in the twin breastplates Urim and Thummim of the Old Testament that would enable Smith himself to translate the aforesaid book. After many wrestlings, he brought this buried apparatus home with him on September the 21st, 1827, about 18 months after his conviction for fraud. He then set about producing a translation. The resulting books turned out to be a record set down by ancient prophets, beginning with Nephi, son of Lephi, who had fled Jerusalem in approximately 600 BC and come to America. Many battles, curses, and afflictions accompanied their subsequent wanderings and those of their numerous progeny. How did the books turn out to be this way? Smith refused to show the golden plates to anybody, claiming that for other eyes to view them would mean death. But he encountered a problem that will be familiar to students of Islam. He was extremely glib and fluent as a debater and story weaver, as many accounts attest. But he was illiterate, at least in the sense that while he could read a little, he could not write. A scribe was therefore necessary to take his inspired dictation. This scribe was at first his wife Emma, and then, when more hands were necessary, a luckless neighbour named Martin Harris. Hearing Smith cite the words of Isaiah 29, verses 11 to 12, concerning the repeated injunction to read, Harris mortgaged his farm to help in the task and moved in with the Smiths. He sat on one side of a blanket hung across the kitchen, and Smith sat on the other with his translation stones, intoning through the blanket. As if to make this an even happier scene, Harris was warned that if he tried to glimpse the plates or look at the prophet, he'd be struck dead. Mrs. Harris was having none of this, and was already furious with the fecklessness of her husband. She stole the first 116 pages, and challenged Smith to reproduce them, as presumably, given his power of revelation, he could. Determined women like this appear far too seldom in the history of religion. After a very bad few weeks, the ingenious Smith countered with another revelation. He could not replicate the original, which might be in the devil's hands by now and open to a satanic verse's interpretation. But the all-foreseeing Lord had, meanwhile, furnished some smaller plates, indeed the very plates of Nephi, which told a fairly similar tale. With infinite labour, the translation was resumed, with new scriveners behind the blanket as occasion demanded. And when it was completed, all the original golden plates were transported to heaven, where apparently they remain to this day. Mormon partisans sometimes say, as do Muslims, that this cannot have been fraudulent because the work of deception would have been too much for one poor and illiterate man. They have on their side 2 useful points. If Muhammad was ever convicted in public of fraud and attempted necromancy, we have no record of the fact, and Arabic is a language that is somewhat opaque, even to the fairly fluent outsider. However, we know the Quran to be made up in part of earlier books and stories, and in the case of Smith it is likewise a simple if tedious task to discover that 25,000 words of the Book of Mormon are taken directly from the Old Testament. These words can mainly be found in the chapters of Isaiah available in Ethan Smith's View of the Hebrews, the 10 Tribes of Israel in America. This then popular work by a pious loony, claiming that the American Indians originated in the Middle East, seems to have started the other Smith on his gold digging in the first place. A further 2,000 words of the Book of Mormon are taken from the New Testament. Of the 350 names in the book, more than 100 come straight from the Bible, and 100 more are as near stolen as makes no difference. The great Mark Twain famously referred to it as chloroform in print, but I accuse him of hitting too soft a target, since the book does actually contain the Book of Ether. The words, "and it came to pass," can be found at least 2,000 times, which does admittedly have a soporific effect. Quite recent scholarship has exposed every single other Mormon document as at best a scrawny compromise and at worst a pitiful fake, as Dr. Brody was obliged to notice when she reissued and updated her remarkable book in 1973. Like Muhammad, Smith could produce divine revelations at short notice and often simply to suit himself, especially, and like Muhammad, when he wanted a new girl and wished to take her as another wife. As a result, he overreached himself and came to a violent end, having meanwhile excommunicated almost all the poor men who had been his first disciples and who'd been browbeaten into taking his dictation. Still, this story raises some very absorbing questions concerning what happens when a plain racket turns into a serious religion before our eyes. Professor Daniel Dennett and his supporters have attracted a great deal of criticism for their natural science explanation of religion. Never mind the supernatural, argues Dennett. We may discard that while accepting that there have always been those for whom belief in belief is a good thing in itself. Phenomena can be explained in biological terms. In primitive times, is it not possible that those who believed in the shaman's cure had a better morale as a result, and thus a slightly but significantly higher chance of actually being cured? Miracles, and similar nonsense to one side, not even modern medicine rejects this thought. And it seems possible, moving into the psychological arena, that people can be better off believing in something than in nothing, however untrue that something may be. Some of this will always be disputed among anthropologists and other scientists, but what interests me, and always has, is this. Do the preachers and prophets also believe, or do they too just believe in belief? Do they ever think to themselves, this is too easy? And do they then rationalize the trick by saying either A, if these wretches weren't listening to me, they'd be in even worse shape, or B, that if it doesn't do them any good, then it still can't be doing them much harm. Sir James Frazer, in his famous study of religion and magic, The Golden Bough, suggests that the novice witch doctor is better off if he does not share the illusions of the ignorant congregation. For one thing, if he does take the magic literally, he's much more likely to make a career-ending mistake. Better by far to be a cynic and to rehearse the contrary, and to tell himself that everybody is better off in the end. Smith obviously seems like a mere cynic in that he was never happier than when using his revelation to claim supreme authority, or to justify the idea that the flock should make over their property to him, or to sleep with every available woman. There are gurus and cult leaders of that kind born every day. Smith must certainly have thought it was too easy to get innocent wretches like Martin Harris to believe everything he told them, especially when they were thirsty for just a glimpse of that mouth-watering golden trove. But was there a moment when he also believed that he did have a destiny and was ready to die to prove it? In other words, was he a huckster all the time, or was there a pulse inside him somewhere? The study of religion suggests to me that while it cannot possibly get along without great fraud and also minor fraud, this remains a fascinating and somewhat open question. There were dozens of part-educated, unscrupulous, ambitious, fanatical men like Smith in the Palmyra, New York area at that epoch, but only one of them achieved takeoff. This is for two probable reasons. First, and by all accounts, including those of his enemies, Smith had great natural charm and authority and fluency, what Max Weber called the charismatic part of leadership. Second, there were at that time a great number of people hungry for soil and a new start in the West, constituting a huge latent force behind the notion of a new leader, let alone a new holy book, that could augur a promised land. The wanderings of the Mormons in Missouri and Illinois and Utah, and the massacres that they both suffered and inflicted on the way, gave body and sinew to the idea of martyrdom and exile, and to the idea of the Gentiles, as they scornfully called the unbelievers. It is a great historical story, and, unlike its origin in a piece of vulgar fabrication, can be read with respect. It does, however, have two indelible stains. The first is the sheer obviousness and crudity of its revelations, which were opportunistically improvised by Smith and later by his successors as they went along. And the second is its revoltingly crude racism. Christian preachers of all kinds had justified slavery until the American Civil War and even afterwards, on the supposed biblical warrant that of the three sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth, Ham had been cursed and cast into servitude. But Joseph Smith took this nasty fable even further, fulminating in his Book of Abraham that the swarthy races of Egypt had inherited this very curse. Also, at the made-up Battle of Cumorah, a site located conveniently near his own birthplace, the Nephites, described as fair-skinned and handsome, contended against the Lamanites, whose descendants were punished with dark pigment for turning away from God. As the crisis over American slavery mounted, Smith and his even more dubious disciples preached against the abolitionists in antebellum Missouri. They solemnly said that there had been a third group in heaven during the ultimate battle between God and Lucifer. This group, as it was explained, had tried to remain neutral, but after Lucifer's defeat they had been forced into the world, compelled to take bodies in the accursed lineage of Canaan, and hence the Negro or African race. Thus, when Dr. Brody first wrote her book, no black American was allowed to hold even the lowly position of deacon, let alone a priesthood, in the Mormon Church. Nor were the descendants of Ham admitted to the sacred rites of the temple. If anything proves the human manufacture of religion, it is the way that the Mormon elders resolve this difficulty. Confronted by the plain words of one of their holy books, and the increasing contempt and isolation that it imposed upon them, they did as they had done when their fondness for polygamy would have brought federal retribution upon God's own Utah. They had still another revelation, and more or less in time for the passage of the Civil Rights Act of 1965, had it divinely disclosed to them that black people were human after all. It must be said for the Latter-day Saints, these conceited words were added to Smith's original Church of Jesus Christ in 1833, that they have squarely faced one of the great difficulties of revealed religion. This is the problem of what to do about those who were born before the exclusive revelation, or who died without ever having the opportunity to share in its wonders. Christians used to resolve this problem by saying that Jesus descended into hell after his crucifixion, where it is thought that he saved or converted the dead. There is indeed a fine passage in Dante's Inferno where he comes to rescue the spirits of great men like Aristotle, who had presumably been boiling away for centuries until he got round to them. In another less ecumenical scene from the same book, the Prophet Muhammad is found being disemboweled in revolting detail. The Mormons have improved on this rather backdated solution with something very literal-minded. They have assembled a gigantic genealogical database at a huge repository in Utah and are busy filling it with the names of all people whose births, marriages, and deaths have been tabulated since records began. This is very useful if you want to look up your own family tree, and as long as you do not object to having your ancestors becoming Mormons. Every week, at special ceremonies in Mormon temples, the congregations meet and are given a certain quota of names of the departed to pray in to their church. This retrospective baptism of the dead seems harmless enough to me, but the American Jewish Committee became incensed when it was discovered that the Mormons had acquired the records of the Nazi final solution and were industriously baptizing what for once could truly be called a lost tribe, the murdered Jews of Europe. For all its touching inefficacy, this exercise seemed in poor taste. I sympathize with the American Jewish Committee, but I nonetheless think that the followers of Mr. Smith should be congratulated for hitting upon even the most simple-minded technological answer to a problem that has defied solution ever since man first invented religion. Chapter 12. A Coda. How Religions End. It can be equally useful and instructive to take a glimpse at the closing of religions or religious movements. The Millerites, for example, are no more, and we shall not hear again, in any but the most vestigial and nostalgic way, of Pan or Osiris or any of the thousands of gods who once held people in utter thrall. But I have to confess to a slight sympathy that I have tried and failed to repress for Sabbatai Zevi, the most imposing of the false messiahs. In the mid-17th century, he galvanized whole Jewish communities across the Mediterranean and the Levant, and as far afield as Poland, Hamburg, and even Amsterdam, repudiator of Spinoza, with his claim to be the chosen one who would lead the exiles back to the Holy Land and begin the era of universal peace. His key to revelation was the study of the Kabbalah, more recently revived in fashion by a showbiz woman bizarrely known as Madonna, and his arrival was greeted by hysterical Jewish congregations from his home base in Smyrna to Salonika, Constantinople, and Aleppo. The rabbis of Jerusalem, having been inconvenienced by premature messianic claims before, were more skeptical. by the use of Kabbalistic conjury that made his own name the equivalent of Moshek, or Messiah, when unscrambled from a Hebrew anagram, he may have persuaded himself, and certainly persuaded others, that he was the expected one. As one of his disciples phrased it, the prophet Nathan prophesied, and Sabbatai Zevi preached, that whoever did not mend his ways would not behold the comforting of Zion and Jerusalem, and that they would be condemned to shame and to everlasting contempt. And there was a repentance, the like of which has never been seen, since the world was created and unto this day. This was no crude Millerite panic. Scholars and learned men debated the question passionately and in writing, and as a consequence we have a very good record of events. All the elements of a true and a false prophecy were present. Sabbatai's devotees pointed to his equivalent of John the Baptist, a charismatic rabbi called Nathan of Gaza. Sabbatai's enemies described him as an epileptic and a heretic and accused him of violating the law. They in turn were stoned by Sabbatai's partisans. Convocations and congregations raged together and raged against each other. On a voyage to announce himself in Constantinople, Sabbatai's ship was storm-tossed, yet he rebuked the waters, and when incarcerated by the Turks, his prison was illuminated with holy fires and sweet scents, or not, according to many discrepant accounts. Echoing a very harsh Christian dispute, the supporters of Rabbi Nathan and Sabbatai maintained that without faith, knowledge of the Torah and the performance of good works would be unavailing. Their opponents asserted that the Torah and good works were the main thing. So complete in every respect was the drama that even the stubbornly anti-Sabbatai rabbis in Jerusalem at one point asked to be told if any verifiable miracles or signs had been attached to the claimant who was intoxicating the Jews with joy. Men and women sold all that they had and prepared to follow him to the promised land. The Ottoman imperial authorities had a good deal of experience in dealing with civil unrest among confessional minorities at the time. They were just in the process of wresting Crete from the Venetians, and behaved with much more circumspection than the Romans are supposed to have done. They understood that if Sabbatai was to claim kingdom over all kings, let alone to claim a large tract of their province in Palestine, then he was a secular challenger as well as a religious one. But when he arrived in Constantinople, all they did was lock him up. The ulema, or Muslim religious authority, was likewise sagacious. They counseled against the execution of this turbulent subject, lest his enthused believers make a new religion. The script was almost complete when a former disciple of Sabbatai's, one Nehemiah Cohen, came to the Grand Vizier's headquarters in Edirne and denounced his former master as a practitioner of immorality and heresy. Summoned to the Vizier's palace and allowed to make his way from prison with a procession of hymn-singing supporters, the Messiah was very bluntly asked if he would agree to a trial by ordeal. The archers of the court would use him as a target, and if heaven deflected the arrows, he would be adjudged genuine. Should he refuse, he would be impaled. If he wished to decline the choice altogether, he could affirm himself to be a true Muslim and be allowed to live. Sabbatai Zevi did what almost any ordinary mammal would have done, made the standard profession of belief in the one God and his messenger, and was awarded a sinecure. He was later deported to an almost Judenrein part of the empire on the Albanian-Montenegrin border, and there expired, supposedly on Yom Kippur, 1676, at the precise hour of evening prayer when Moses is said to have breathed his last. His grave, much sought, has never been conclusively identified. His distraught followers immediately divided into several factions. There were those who refused to believe in his conversion or apostasy. There were those who argued that he had only become a Muslim in order to be an even greater Messiah. There were those who felt that he had only adopted a disguise. And of course there were those who claimed that he had risen into the heavens. His true disciples eventually adopted the doctrine of occultation, which, it may not surprise you to learn, involves the belief that the Messiah, invisible to us, has not died at all, but awaits the moment when humanity will be ready for his magnificent return. Occultation is also the term employed by pious Shia to describe the present and long-standing condition of the 12th Imam or Mahdi, a child of five who apparently vanished from human view in the year 873. So the Sabbatai Zevi religion came to an end and survives only in the tiny syncretic sect known in Turkey as the Donme, which conceals a Jewish loyalty within an outward Islamic observance. But had its founder been put to death, we should be hearing of it still, and of the elaborate mutual excommunications, stonings and schisms that its followers would subsequently have engaged in. The nearest approximation in our own day is the Hasidic sect known as Chabad, the Lubavitcher movement once led and, according to some, still led, by Menachem Schneerson. This man's death in Brooklyn in 1994 was confidently expected to produce an age of redemption, which it so far has not. The United States Congress had already established an official day in Schneerson's honor in 1983. Just as there are still Jewish sects who maintain that the Nazi final solution was a punishment for living in exile from Jerusalem, so there are those who preserve the ghetto policy which maintained a watcher at the gates, whose job it was to alert the others if the Messiah arrived unexpectedly. It's steady work, as one of these watchmen is supposed, rather defensively, to have said. Surveying the not-quite-and-might-have-been religions, one could experience a slight feeling of pathos, were it not for the constant din of other sermonizers, all of them claiming that it is their Messiah, and not anybody else's, who is to be awaited with servility and awe. Chapter 13. Does religion make people behave better? A little more than a century after Joseph Smith fell victim to the violence and mania that he had helped to unleash, another prophetic voice was raised in the United States. A young black pastor named Dr. Martin Luther King began to preach that his people, the descendants of the very slavery that Joseph Smith and all other Christian churches had so warmly approved, should be free. It is quite impossible, even for an atheist like myself, to read his sermons or watch recordings of his speeches without profound emotion of the sort that can sometimes bring genuine tears. Dr. King's letter from Birmingham jail, written in response to a group of white Christian clerics who had urged him to show restraint and patience, in other words, to know his place, is a model of polemic. Icily polite and generous-minded, it still breathes with an unquenchable conviction that the filthy injustice of racism must be borne no longer. Taylor Branch's magnificent three-volume biography of Dr. King is successively titled Parting the Waters, Pillar of Fire, and At Canaan's Edge. And the rhetoric with which King addressed his followers was designed to evoke the very story that they all knew best, the one that begins when Moses first tells Pharaoh to let my people go. In speech after speech, he inspired the oppressed and exhorted and shamed their oppressors. Slowly, the embarrassed religious leadership of the country moved to his side. Rabbi Abraham Heschel asked, "Where in America today do we hear a voice like the voice of the prophets of Israel?" Martin Luther King is a sign that God has not forsaken the United States of America. Most eerie of all, if we follow the Mosaic narrative, was the sermon that King gave on the last night of his life. His work of transforming public opinion and shifting the stubborn Kennedy and Johnson administrations was almost done, and he was in Memphis, Tennessee, to support a long and bitter strike by the city's ground-down garbage collectors, on whose placards appeared the simple words, "I am a man." In the pulpit at Mason Temple, he reviewed the protracted struggle of the past years and then very suddenly said, "But it doesn't matter with me now." There was silence until he went on, "Because I've been to the mountaintop and I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will, and he's allowed me to go up the mountain, and I've looked over, and I've seen the promised land. And I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land." Nobody who was there that night has ever forgotten it, and I dare say the same can be said for anyone who views the film that was so fortunately taken of that transcendent moment. The next best way of experiencing this feeling at second hand is to listen to how Nina Simone sang that same terrible week, "The King of Love is Dead." The entire drama has the capacity to unite elements of Moses on Mount Nebo with the agony in the Garden of Gethsemane. The effect is scarcely diminished, even when we discover that this was one of his favourite sermons, and one that he had delivered several times before, and into which he could slip as occasion demanded. But the examples King gave from the books of Moses were, fortunately for all of us, metaphors and allegories. His most imperative preaching was that of non-violence. In his version of the story, there are no savage punishments and genocidal bloodlettings, nor are there cruel commandments about the stoning of children and the burning of witches. His persecuted and despised people were not promised the territory of others, nor were they incited to carry out the pillage and murder of other tribes. In the face of endless provocation and brutality, King beseeched his followers to become what they for a while truly became, the moral tutors of America and of the world beyond its shores. He in effect forgave his murderer in advance. The one detail that would have made his last public words flawless and perfect would have been an actual declaration to that effect. But the difference between him and the prophets of Israel could not possibly have been more marked. If the population had been raised from its mother's knee to hear the story of Xenophon's Anabasis and the long, wearying, dangerous journey of the Greeks to their triumphant view of the sea, that allegory might have done just as well. As it was, though, the good book was the only point of reference that everybody had in common. Christian reformism arose originally from the ability of its advocates to contrast the Old Testament with the New. The cobbled-together ancient Jewish books had an ill-tempered and implacable and bloody and provincial God, who was probably more frightening when he was in a good mood, the classic attribute of the dictator. Whereas the cobbled-together books of the last 2,000 years contained handholds for the hopeful, and references to meekness, forgiveness, lambs and sheep, and so forth. This distinction is more apparent than real, since it is only in the reported observations of Jesus that we find any mention of hell and eternal punishment. The God of Moses would brusquely call for other tribes, including his favourite one, to suffer massacre and plague and even extirpation, but when the grave closed over his victims, he was essentially finished with them, unless he remembered to curse their succeeding progeny. Not until the advent of the Prince of Peace do we hear of the ghastly idea of further punishing and torturing the dead. First presaged by the rantings of John the Baptist, the Son of God is revealed as one who, if his milder words are not accepted straight away, will condemn the inattentive to everlasting fire. This has provided texts for clerical sadists ever since and features very lip-smackingly in the tirades of Islam. At no point did Dr. King, who was once photographed in a bookstore, waiting calmly for a physician, while the knife of a maniac was sticking straight out of his chest, even hint that those who injured and reviled him were to be threatened with any revenge or punishment in this world or the next, save the consequences of their own brute selfishness and stupidity. And he even phrased that appeal more courteously than, in my humble opinion, its targets deserved. In no real as opposed to nominal sense, then, was he a Christian. This does not in the least diminish his standing as a great preacher, any more does the fact that he was a mammal like the rest of us, and probably plagiarized his doctoral dissertation, and had a notorious fondness for booze and for women a good deal younger than his wife. He spent the remainder of his last evening in orgiastic dissipation, for which I don't blame him. These things, which of course disturb the faithful, are rather encouraging in that they show that a high moral character is not a precondition for great moral accomplishments. But if his example is to be deployed, as it often is, to show that religion has an uplifting and liberating effect, then let us examine the wider claim. Taking the memorable story of Black America as our instance, we should find first that the enslaved were not captives of some pharaoh, but of several Christian states and societies that for many years operated a triangular trade between the west coast of Africa, the eastern seaboard of North America, and the capitals of Europe. This huge and terrible industry was blessed by all churches and for a long time aroused absolutely no religious protest. Its counterpart, the slave trade in the Mediterranean and North Africa, was explicitly endorsed by and carried out in the name of Islam. In the 18th century, a few dissenting Mennonites and Quakers in America began to call for abolition, as did some free thinkers like Thomas Paine. Thomas Jefferson, ruminating on the way that slavery corrupted and brutalized the masters, as well as exploited and tortured the slaves, wrote, "Indeed, I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just." This was a statement as incoherent as it is memorable. Given the marvel of a God who was also just, there would be, in the long term, nothing much to tremble about. At any rate, the Almighty managed to tolerate the situation, while several generations were born and died under the lash, and until slavery became less profitable, and even the British Empire began to get rid of it. This was the spur for the revival of abolitionism. It sometimes took a Christian form, most notably in the case of William Lloyd Garrison, the great orator and founder of The Liberator. Mr. Garrison was a splendid man by any standards, but it is probably fortunate that all of his early religious advice was not followed. He based his initial claim on the dangerous verse from Isaiah that calls on the faithful to come out and be separated. This is also the theological basis of Ian Paisley's fundamentalist and bigoted Presbyterianism in Northern Ireland. In Garrison's view, the Union and the United States Constitution were a covenant with death and ought both to be destroyed. It was, in effect, he who called for secession before the Confederates did. In later life, he discovered the work of Thomas Paine and became less of a preacher and a more effective abolitionist, as well as an early supporter of female suffrage. It was the escaped slave Frederick Douglass, author of the stirring and mordant autobiography, who eschewed apocalyptic language and demanded instead that the United States live up to the universalist promises contained in its Declaration and its Constitution. The lion-like John Brown, who also began as a fearsome and pitiless Calvinist, did the same. Later in life, he had Paine's works in his camp and admitted freethinkers to his tiny but epoch-changing army, and even produced and printed a new declaration, modelled on that of 1776, on behalf of the enslaved. This was, in practice, a much more revolutionary as well as a more realistic demand, and prepared the way, as Lincoln admitted, for the Emancipation Proclamation. Douglas was somewhat ambivalent about religion, noting in his autobiography that the most devout Christians made the most savage slaveholders. The obvious truth of this was underlined when secession really did come, and the Confederacy adopted the Latin motto Deo Vindice, or in effect, God on our side. As Lincoln pointed out in his highly ambivalent second inaugural address, both sides in the quarrel made that claim, at least in their pulpits, just as both were addicted to loud, confident quotations from Holy Writ. Lincoln himself was hesitant to claim authority in this manner. In fact, at one point he famously said that such invocations of the divine were wrong, because it was rather a matter of trying to be on God's side. Pressed to issue an immediate Emancipation Proclamation at a gathering of Christians in Chicago, he continued to see both sides of the argument as endorsed by faith, and said that these are not, however, the days of miracles, and I suppose it will be granted that I am not to expect a direct revelation. This was neatly evasive, yet when he finally did nerve himself to issue the proclamation, he told the remaining waverers that he had promised himself to do so, on condition that God gave victory to the Union forces at Antietam. On that day, the largest ever number of deaths on United States soil was recorded. So it is possible that Lincoln wanted somehow to sanctify and justify that appalling carnage. This would be a noble enough thing until one reflects that on the same logic, the same carnage decided the other way would have postponed the freeing of the slaves. As he also said, the rebel soldiers are praying with a great deal more earnestness, I fear, than our own troops, and expecting God to favour their side. For one of our soldiers, who had been taken prisoner, said that he met with nothing so discouraging as the evident sincerity of those he was among in their prayers. One more bit of battlefield luck for the grey uniforms at Antietam, and the president might have become worried that God had deserted the anti-slavery cause altogether. We do not know Lincoln's private religious beliefs. He was fond of references to Almighty God, but he never joined any church, and his early candidacies were much opposed by clergymen. His friend Herndon knew that he had read Paine and Volney and other freethinkers very closely, and formed the opinion that he was privately an outright unbeliever. This seems improbable. However, it would also be inaccurate to say that he was a Christian. Much evidence supports the view that he was a tormented sceptic with a tendency to deism. Whatever may be the case, the very most that can be said for religion in the grave matter of abolition is that, after many hundreds of years, and having both imposed and postponed the issue, until self-interest had led to a horrifying war, it finally managed to undo some small part of the damage and misery that it had inflicted in the first place. The same can be said of the King epoch. The Southern churches returned to their old ways after Reconstruction and blessed the new institutions of segregation and discrimination. It was not until after the Second World War and the spread of decolonization and human rights that the cry for emancipation was raised again. In response, it was again very forcefully asserted, on American soil, in the second half of the 20th century, that the discrepant descendants of Noah were not intended by God to be mixed. This barbaric stupidity had real-world consequences. The late Senator Eugene McCarthy told me that he had once urged Senator Pat Robertson, father of the present television prophet, to support some mild civil rights legislation. "I'd sure like to help the colored," came the response, "but the Bible says I can't." The entire self-definition of the South was that it was white and Christian. This is exactly what gave Dr. King his moral leverage, because he could outpreach the rednecks. But the heavy burden would never have been laid upon him if religiosity had not been so deeply entrenched to begin with. As Taylor Branch shows in his trilogy, many of King's inner circle and entourage were secular communists and socialists who had been manuring the ground for a civil rights movement for several decades and helping train brave volunteers like Mrs. Rosa Parks for a careful strategy of mass civil disobedience. And these atheistic associations were to be used against King all the time, especially from the pulpit. Indeed, one result of his campaign was to generate the backlash of white, right-wing Christianity, which is still such a potent force below the Mason-Dixon line. When Dr. King's namesake nailed his theses to the door of Wittenberg Cathedral in 1517 and stoutly announced, "Here I stand, I can do no other," he set a standard for intellectual and moral courage. But Martin Luther, who started his religious life being terribly frightened by a near-miss lightning strike, went on to become a bigot and a persecutor in his own right, railing murderously against Jews, screaming about demons, and calling on the German principalities to stamp on the rebellious poor. When Dr. King took a stand on the steps of Mr. Lincoln's memorial and changed history, he too adopted a position that had effectually been forced upon him. But he did so as a profound humanist, and nobody could ever use his name to justify oppression or cruelty. He endures for that reason, and his legacy has very little to do with his professed theology. No supernatural force was required to make the case against racism. Anybody, therefore, who uses the King legacy to justify the role of religion in public life must accept all the corollaries of what they seem to be implying. Even a glance at the whole record will show, first, that, person for person, American freethinkers and agnostics and atheists come out the best. The chance that someone's secular or freethinking opinion would cause him or her to denounce the whole injustice was extremely high. The chance that someone's religious belief would cause him or her to take a stand against slavery and racism was statistically quite small. But the chance that someone's religious belief would cause him or her to uphold slavery and racism was statistically extremely high. And the latter fact helps us to understand why the victory of simple justice took so long to bring about. As far as I am aware, there is no country in the world today where slavery is still practiced, where the justification of it is not derived from the Quran. This returns us to the retort delivered in the very early days of the Republic to Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. These two slaveholders had called on the ambassador of Tripoli in London to ask him by what right he and his fellow Barbary potentates presumed to capture and sell American crews and passengers from ships using the Strait of Gibraltar. It is now estimated that between 1530 and 1780, more than 1.25 million Europeans were carried off in this way, as Jefferson reported to Congress. The ambassador answered us that it was founded on the laws of the Prophet, that it was written in their Quran, that all nations who should not have answered their authority were sinners, that it was their right and duty to make war upon them whenever they could be found, and to make slaves of all they could take as prisoners. Ambassador Abdurrahman went on to mention the requisite price of ransom, the price of protection from kidnapping, and last but not least, his own personal commission in these proceedings. Religion once again betrays its man-made conveniences. As it happens, he was quite right in what he said about the Quran. The 8th surah, revealed at Medina, deals at some length with the justified spoils of war and dwells continually on the further post-mortem torments of fire that await those who are defeated by the believers. It was this very surah that was to be used only 2 centuries later by Saddam Hussein to justify his mass murder and dispossession of the people of Kurdistan. Another grand historical episode, the emancipation of India from colonial rule, is often portrayed as though it involved a connection between religious belief and ethical outcomes. As with the heroic battle of Dr. King, the real story tends to show that something like the opposite is the case. After the critical weakening of the British Empire by the First World War, and most particularly after the notorious massacre of Indian protesters at the city of Amritsar in April 1919, it became apparent even to the then controllers of the subcontinent that rule from London would come to an end sooner rather than later. It was no longer a matter of if, but of when. Had this not been the case, a campaign of peaceful disobedience would have stood no chance. Thus, Mohandas K. Gandhi, sometimes known as the Mahatma, in respect for his standing as a Hindu elder, was in a sense pushing at an open door. There is no dishonour in that, but it is exactly his religious convictions that make his legacy a dubious rather than a saintly one. To state the matter shortly, he wanted India to revert to a village-dominated and primitive spiritual society. He made power-sharing with Muslims much harder, and he was quite prepared to make hypocritical use of violence when he thought it might suit him. The whole question of Indian independence was interleaved with the question of unity. Would the former British Raj be reborn as the same country, with the same borders and territorial integrity, and yet still be called India? To this, a certain rugged faction of Muslims answered no. Under British rule, they had enjoyed some protection as a very large minority, not to say a privileged one. and they were not willing to exchange this state of affairs for becoming a large minority in a Hindu-dominated state. Thus, the sheer fact that the main force for independence, the Congress Party, was dominated by a conspicuous Hindu, made conciliation very difficult. It could be argued, and indeed I would argue, that Muslim intransigence would have played a destructive role in any case. But the task of persuading ordinary Muslims to leave Congress and join with the partitionist Muslim League was made much easier by Gandhi's talk of Hinduism and by the long, ostentatious hours he spent in cultish practices and in tending his spinning wheel. This wheel, which still appears as the symbol on the Indian flag, was the emblem of Gandhi's rejection of modernity. He took to dressing in rags of his own manufacture and sandals, and to carrying a staff and expressing hostility to machinery and technology. He rhapsodized about the Indian village, where the millennial rhythms of animals and crops would determine how human life was lived. Millions of people would have mindlessly starved to death if his advice had been followed, and would have continued to worship cows, cleverly denominated by the priests as sacred, so that the poor ignorant people would not kill and eat their only capital during times of drought and famine. Gandhi deserves credit for his criticism of the inhuman Hindu system of caste, whereby lower orders of humanity were condemned to an ostracism and contempt that was in some ways even more absolute and cruel than slavery. But at just the moment when what India most needed was a modern secular nationalist leader, it got a fakir and a guru instead. The crux of this unwelcome realization came in 1941, when the Imperial Japanese Army had conquered Malaya and Burma and was on the frontiers of India itself. Believing, wrongly, that this spelled the end of the Raj, Gandhi chose this moment to boycott the political process and issue his notorious call for the British to quit India. He added that they should leave it to God or to anarchy, which in the circumstances would have meant much the same thing. Those who naively credit Gandhi with a conscientious or consistent pacifism might wish to ask if this did not amount to letting the Japanese imperialists do his fighting for him. Among the many bad consequences of the Gandhi Congress decision to withdraw from negotiations was the opening it gave to Muslim League adherents to stay on in the state ministries which they controlled, and thus to enhance their bargaining positions when the moment for independence arrived shortly thereafter. Their insistence that independence take the form of mutilation and amputation, with western Punjab and eastern Bengal hacked away from the national body, became unstoppable. The hideous consequences endure to this day, with further Muslim-on-Muslim bloodbaths in Bangladesh in 1971, the rise of an aggressive Hindu nationalist party, and a confrontation in Kashmir that is still the likeliest provocation for a thermonuclear war. There was always an alternative in the form of the secular position taken by Nehru and Rajago Palachari, who would have traded a British promise of immediate post-war independence for a common alliance on the part of both India and Britain against fascism. In the event, it was in fact Nehru and not Gandhi who led his country to independence, even at the awful price of partition. For decades, a solid brotherhood between British and Indian secularists and leftists had laid out the case for, and won the argument for, the liberation of India. There was never any need for an obscurantist religious figure to impose his ego on the process and both retard and distort it. The whole case was complete without that assumption. One wishes every day that Martin Luther King had lived on and continued to lend his presence and his wisdom to American politics. For the Mahatma, who was murdered by members of a fanatical Hindu sect for not being devout enough, one wishes that he could have lived, if only to see what damage he'd wrought, and is relieved that he did not live to implement his ludicrous spinning wheel program. The argument that religious belief improves people, or that it helps to civilize society, is one that people tend to bring up when they have exhausted the rest of their case. Very well, they seem to say, we cease to insist on the Exodus, say, or the virgin birth, or even the resurrection, or the night flight from Mecca to Jerusalem. But where would people be without faith? Would they not abandon themselves to every kind of license and selfishness? Is it not true, as G.K. Chesterton once famously said, that if people cease to believe in God, they do not believe in nothing but in anything? The first thing to be said is that virtuous behavior by a believer is no proof at all of, indeed is not even an argument for, the truth of his belief. I might, just for the sake of argument, act more charitably if I believed that Lord Buddha was born from a slit in his mother's side. But would not this make my charitable impulse dependent upon something rather tenuous? By the same token, I do not say that if I catch a Buddhist priest stealing all the offerings left by the simple folk at his temple, Buddhism itself is thereby discredited. And we forget in any case how contingent all this is. Of the thousands of possible desert religions there were, as with the millions of potential species there were, one branch happened to take root and grow. Passing through its Jewish mutations to its Christian form, it was eventually adopted for political reasons by the Emperor Constantine and made into an official faith with, eventually, a a codified and enforceable form of its many chaotic and contradictory books. As for Islam, it became the ideology of a highly successful conquest that was adopted by successful ruling dynasties, codified and set down in its turn, and promulgated as the law of the land. One or two military victories the other way, as with Lincoln at Antietam, and we in the West would not be the hostages of village disputes that took place in Judea and Arabia before any serious records were kept. We could have become the votaries of another belief altogether, perhaps a Hindu or an Aztec or a Confucian one, in which case we should still be told that, strictly true or not, it nonetheless helped teach the children the difference between right and wrong. In other words, to believe in a god is in one way to express a willingness to believe in anything, whereas to reject the belief is by no means to profess belief in nothing. I once watched the late Professor A.J. Ayer, the distinguished author of Language, Truth, and Logic, and a celebrated humanist, debate with a certain Bishop Butler. The chairman was the philosopher Brian McGee. The exchange proceeded politely enough until the bishop, hearing Ayer assert that he saw no evidence at all for the existence of any god, broke in to say, "Then I cannot see why you do not lead a life of unbridled immorality." At this point, Freddy, as his friends knew him, abandoned his normal suave urbanity and exclaimed, "I must say that I think that's a perfectly monstrous insinuation." Now, Freddy had certainly broken most commandments respecting the sexual code as adumbrated from Sinai. He was, in a way, justly famous for this. But he was an excellent teacher, a loving parent, and a man who spent much of his spare time pressing for human rights and free speech. To say that his life was an immoral one would be a travesty of the truth. From the many writers who exemplify the same point in a different way, I shall select Evelyn Waugh, who was of the same faith as Bishop Butler, and who did his best in his fiction to argue for the operations of divine grace. In his novel Brideshead Revisited, he makes a very acute observation. The two protagonists, Sebastian Flight and Charles Ryder, the first of whom is heir to an old Catholic nobility, are visited by Father Phipps, who believes that all young men must be passionately interested in cricket. When disabused of this notion, he looks at Charles with the expression I have seen since in the religious, of innocent wonder that those who expose themselves to the dangers of the world should avail themselves so little of its varied solace. Thus I re-scrutinize Bishop Butler's question. Was he in fact not telling Ayer, in his own naive way, that if freed from the restraints of doctrine, he himself would choose to lead a life of unbridled immorality? One naturally hopes not, but much empirical evidence exists to reinforce the suggestion. When priests go bad, they go very bad indeed, and commit crimes that would make the average sinner pale. One might prefer to attribute this to sexual repression than to the actual doctrines preached, but then one of the actual doctrines preached is sexual repression. Thus the connection is unavoidable, and a litany of folkloric jokes have been told by all lay members of the church ever since religion began. Waugh's own life was far more stained by offences against chastity and sobriety than was the life of Ayer, only it seemed to bring less happiness to the former than to the latter. And in consequence, he was often asked how he reconciled his private conduct with his public beliefs. His reply has become celebrated. He asked his friends to imagine how much worse he would be if he were not a Catholic. For a believer in original sin, this might have served as a turning of the tables, but any examination of Waugh's actual life shows that its most wicked elements arose precisely from his faith. Never mind the sad excesses of drunkenness and marital infidelity, he once sent a wedding telegram to a divorced and now remarried friend, telling her that her nuptial night would increase the loneliness of Calvary and add to the spittle on the face of Christ. He supported fascist movements in Spain and Croatia and Mussolini's foul invasion of Abyssinia because they enjoyed the support of the Vatican. And he wrote in 1944 that only the Third Reich now stood between Europe and barbarism. These deformities in one of my most beloved authors arose not in spite of his faith, but because of it. No doubt there were private acts of charity and contrition, but these could equally well have been performed by a person of no faith at all. To look no further than the United States, the great Colonel Robert Ingersoll, who was the nation's leading advocate of unbelief until his death in 1899, maddened his opponents because he was a person of immense generosity, a loving and constant husband and father, a gallant officer, and the possessor of what Thomas Edison with pardonable exaggeration called all the attributes of a perfect man. In my own recent life in Washington, I've been bombarded with obscene and menacing phone calls from Muslims, promising to punish my family because I do not support a campaign of lies and hatred and violence against democratic Denmark. But when my wife accidentally left a large amount of cash on the back seat of a taxi, the Sudanese cab driver went to a good deal of trouble and expense to work out whose property this was, and to drive all the way to my home to return it untouched. When I made the vulgar mistake of offering him 10% of the money, He made it quietly but firmly plain that he expected no recompense for performing his Islamic duty. Which of these two versions of faith is the one to rely upon? The question is in some ways ultimately undecidable. I would prefer to have Evelyn Waugh's shelf of writing just as it is, and to appreciate that one cannot have the novels without the torments and evils of its author. And if all Muslims conducted themselves like the man who gave up more than a week's salary in order to do the right thing, I could be quite indifferent to the weird exhortations of the Quran. If I search my own life for instances of good or fine behaviour, I am not overwhelmed by an excess of choice. I did once, shivering with fear, take off my flak jacket in Sarajevo and lend it to an even more frightened woman who I was helping escort to a place of safety. I am not the only one who has been an atheist in a foxhole. I felt at the time that it was the least I could do for her, as well as the most. The people shelling and sniping were Serbian Christians, but then so was she. In northern Uganda, in late 2005, I sat in a centre for the rehabilitation of kidnapped and enslaved children in the land of the Acholi people who live on the northern side of the Nile. The listless, vacant, hardened little boys and some girls were all around me. Their stories were distressingly similar. They had been seized at the age of anything from 8 to 13 from their schools or homes by a stone-faced militia that was itself originally made up of abducted children. Marched into the bush, they were initiated into the force by one or two of two methods. They either had to take part in a murder themselves in order to feel dirtied up and implicated, or they had to submit to a prolonged and savage whipping, often of up to 300 strokes. Children who have felt cruelty, said one of the editors of the Acholi people, know very well how to inflict it. The misery inflicted by this army of wretches turned zombies was almost beyond computation. It had razed villages, created a vast refugee population, committed hideous crimes such as mutilation and disemboweling, and, in a special touch of evil, had continued to kidnap children, so that the Acholi were wary of taking strong countermeasures lest they kill or injure one of their own. The name of the militia was the Lord's Resistance Army, LRA, and it was led by a man named Joseph Kony, a passionate former altar boy who wanted to subject the area to the rule of the Ten Commandments. He baptized by oil and water, held fierce ceremonies of punishment and purification, and ensured his followers against death. His was a fanatical preachment of Christianity. As it happened, the rehabilitation center in which I was sitting was also run by a fundamentalist Christian organization. Having been out into the bush and seen the work of the LRA, I fell to talking with the man who tried to repair the damage. How did he know, I asked him, which of them was the truest believer? Any secular or state-run outfit could be doing what he was doing, fitting prosthetic limbs and providing shelter and counselling. But in order to be Joseph Kony, one had to have real faith. To my surprise, he did not dismiss my question. It was true, he said, that Kony's authority arose in part from his background in a priestly Christian family. It was also true that people were apt to believe he could work miracles by appealing to the spirit world and promising his acolytes that they were death-proof. Even some of those who had run away would still swear that they had seen wonders performed by the man. All that a missionary could do was to try and show people a different face of Christianity. I was impressed by this man's frankness. There were some other defences that he might have offered. Joseph Kony is obviously far away from the Christian mainstream. For one thing, his paymasters and armourers are the cynical Muslims of the Sudanese regime, who use him to make trouble for the government of Uganda, which has in turn supported rebel groups in Sudan. In an apparent reward for this support, Kony at one stage began denouncing the keeping and eating of pigs, which, unless he has become a fundamentalist Jew in his old age, suggests a payoff to his bosses. These Sudanese murderers, in their turn, have for years been conducting a war of extermination, not just against the Christians and animists of southern Sudan, but against the non-Arab Muslims of Darfur province. Islam may officially make no distinction between races and nations, but the slaughterers in Darfur are Arab Muslims and their victims are African Muslims. The Lord's Resistance Army is nothing but a Christian Khmer Rouge sideshow in this more general horror. An even more graphic example is afforded by the case of Rwanda, which in 1992 gave the world a new synonym for genocide and sadism. This former Belgian possession is the most Christian country in Africa, boasting the highest percentage of churches per head of population, with 65% of Rwandans professing Roman Catholicism, and another 15% adhering to various Protestant sects. The words per head took on a macabre ring in 1992, when at a given signal the racist militias of Hutu power, incited by state and church, fell upon their Tutsi neighbours and slaughtered them en masse. This was no atavistic spasm of bloodletting, but a coldly rehearsed African version of the Final Solution, which had been in preparation for some time. The early warning of it came in 1987, when a Catholic visionary with the deceptively folksy name of Little Pebbles began to boast of hearing voices and seeing visions, these deriving from the Virgin Mary. The said voices and visions were distressingly bloody, predicting massacre and apocalypse, but also, as if in compensation, the return of Jesus Christ on Easter Sunday 1992. Apparition.